Selkirk, and Kamloops. Kate and Ella. To woo or not to woo? Fandom and romance and werewolves in Canada can all go together, as you'll learn from Andrea Clausen, right here on Radio Drama Revival. Hello, and welcome to Radio Drama Revival, the podcast that showcases the diversity and vitality of modern audio fiction. I'm your host, Elena Fernandez Collins. Today, we're interviewing Andrea Clausen, creator of the romance podcast Me and AU, which we featured last week. Fandom has brought a lot of powerful movement in our communities. We have found lifelong friendships, romantic partners, communities you can truly be yourself in, artistic drive, and new ideas. We've also found bitter rivalries, parasocial relationships tipping into bad decisions and toxicity, racism, queerphobia, and other dangerous rhetoric and behavior. Andrea has been in fandom for a long time, and this conversation is about all the facets within the topics of Me and AU, the good and the bad. We are gleeful about headcanons and the city of Kamloops and long-distance romance. We're also honest about parasocial relationships, fandom's far-reaching influence, and the Americanization of media. Me and AU is a cute, light, warm story, one that focuses on the positive outcomes of fandom, but no one here is ignoring reality. I'm about to discuss Indigenous child death for a moment. Please take care of yourself. The time code for where to skip can be found in the episode description. This interview was recorded prior to the public announcement of the discovery of a mass grave at the Kamloops Residential School with the remains of 215 Indigenous children. Preliminary findings are expected in mid-June as the ground survey continues. This is not ancient history. Canadian government and churches operated residential schools and committed innumerable atrocities within them until 1996. 1996. Our hearts are with the Tecumloops de Sehwepemch, the home community of the school who will caretake for these children, and all the First Nations families and communities who continue to suffer the long-lasting effects from this genocide on mental and physical health, language, cultural knowledge, and heritage. You can read the press release from the Office of the Chief at the link in the episode description. On Radio Drama Revival's Twitter, you can also find links to news articles and threads from Indigenous people for more information and guidance. Please stay tuned after the interview for how you can help the local Kamloops Indigenous community. Thank you for your attention. Now, let's welcome Andrea Clausen.
Thank you for coming on to Radio Drama Revival. Andrea, we're really excited to talk about Me and AU with you.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be here. It's been a hot minute since the last
time. It has been a hot minute. Yeah, the last time was when David was still the host and you were on with Alex for Station to Station.
It was.
Yes, I re-listened to that interview and I had to ground David for the final punt he made. For audience members who haven't heard it or don't remember, using the term, the fact that Andrea and Alex talked about being relationship stands, decided to come up with, you know, the stand for relationships. Defend it to the death or go down with the ship. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. David, you're still grounded.
Co-signed.
So, Andrea, let's talk a little bit about your background here. You're a former newspaper reporter in British Columbia, and specifically you did local journalism for the city of Kamloops. Am I pronouncing
it
correctly?
Kamloops.
Dope. I had a moment of like, oh no. Tell me a little bit about how you see your experiences in journalism reflected in the podcasting space since you have been involved, fiction or otherwise.
It's interesting. The thing that I actually found was true when I got into writing audio while I was still doing journalism is that the thing that I think has always been most helpful for it is that I have spent a really, really long time listening to other people talk and then transcribing other people talking because I'm a garbage note taker. And So, like, idiolects and people's different vocal texts have always been really, really interesting to me. So that's actually the place where I think the two things tend to kind of collide for me. I am only kind of just now coming around to being really interested in more kind of nonfiction podcasting. It really started as a fiction space for me, partially just because I used to keep my, like, journalism life and my fiction life really, really, really separate.
Yeah, it's valid.
Yeah. yeah, I had this, like, we'll probably get into this more, but I used to have this, like, really weird, like, hang up about, like, they can't know I'm a person.
I want to talk about Kamloops for a little bit. So you've set this show in the town that you used to work in. You've hired mostly Canadian voice actors, which you have called out as wanting to get away from the dominance of American and British voices in fiction podcasting. Which, yes, 100%. Tell me about Kamloops. What's it like to live there? And specifically, how did you bring the sound of Kamloops to me and AU?
Ooh, this is a good question. So Kamloops itself is a town of about 90,000 people in the interior of British Columbia. For Canada, that's a reasonably big city, is a caveat I have to make here.
It's fair.
it's only like the fifth biggest city in British Columbia, but it has like a weird outsized importance in the province because it had when I worked there the most buck wild overactive media market of any like city of its size that I've ever seen. But also is a bellwether riding for provincial politics, is where a bunch of different national, international and provincial highways hub up for like goods and transportation, and is just kind of like an interesting sort of microcosm of a lot of stuff that's like not what people who live in urban BC think of as BC being like. It's a province that has like, I'm living on Vancouver Island now, and like Vancouver Island and the Lower Mainland are very much like your West Coast kind of stereotypes. Everybody bicycles. you can get really good vegan food anywhere.
I'm in Portland. Oregon. I feel you.
Yeah, and then as you go over the mountains and up into the rest of BC, it is it has a lot more in common with like the Western Canadian kind of personality overall, which is that people tend to be tend to be more likely to work in like resource industries. They tend to vote more conservatively. We think of ourselves as Tim Hortons people, which is too much Canadian culture to unpack, honestly, on this show. But Canadians will know what I mean.
Yeah. For Americans who don't know, Tim Hortons is a very popular Canadian like coffee chain. Coffee, cafe, many other things chain, but that's the basics.
Yeah, it's also occasionally the site of like weird culture wars, but we really won't.
Yeah, that's fair.
But yeah, so Kamloops is sort of medium-sized, like a little bit more conservative, and it's also like high desert, which is sort of weird. It's surrounded by like these beautiful mountainous areas, but it itself is rattlesnakes and cacti. And I think like the interesting thing about bringing the sound of Kamloops in is that in some ways we don't spend a lot of time in Kamloops, but both of the places we really are in Kamloops, which is Kate's job, she works at a unnamed coffee shop that's very obviously a Starbucks, and yeah, at one point we go to a...
I had a moment at the beginning where I was like, is this a Tim Hortons? And then I kept listening, but no. This is a Starbucks.
This is the Starbucks by where I used to work. It's nice. The Starbucks across the street from the Save-On Foods in the Columbia Valley Shopping Plaza in like Lower Sahali. And the other place is a pizza place downtown that has changed owners but used to be called Mile High. And both of those places have like very distinct soundscapes in my head, in that both of them have like the radio on pretty regularly and otherwise are kind of sparse. But it's interesting in a lot of ways because like we don't sonically spend a whole lot of time in Kamloops. So the place that I actually think I ended up thinking about a lot more is West Kootenay, which is the part of BC that I filed the serial numbers off of for the show that's within the show of the podcast. I'm gonna as well just get into that.
No, yeah, get into it. Yeah, yeah, do it.
So Selkirk is based on the very, very start of my reporting career. When I was like 22, 23, I moved to Nelson, BC, which is a couple hours north of the American border by like eastern Washington State. It's in this little mountain bowl. So the only way you can like get into it is either by taking a ferry and then the most harrowing pin turn drive in the world, or by going over literally the highest year-round open mountain pass in Canada.
Wow. Alrighty.
Yeah, everybody who came to visit me got crazily claustrophobic.
I don't blame
you.
Yeah. That happened. But when I lived in Puerto Rico, I had some people drop me off at my house when I was younger. We had like some kind of after-school thing, and they drove me home, and they had never been there before. And as we were going up this mountain, they were like, "You live in the jungle. Are there monkeys here?" I feel so isolated. And I'm just like, have you met my parents? So yeah, I feel that in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
But yeah, like this like venturing out into like this completely unknown, like very different territory.
Yeah, it's a cool little town. Nelson is still my favorite place that I've ever worked because it is exactly like I describe it in the show. It is a place that was settled by a lot of like Vietnam draft dodgers. The Duca Boers settled in the region, which are a religious sect who are Eastern European. I think I can't remember the exact specs right now, but are known for having staged a lot of public nude protests in the 20s. Due to like some very gross stuff that I would urge people to Google if they're curious. But the protest itself is kind of fascinating. It's before pot became legal in Canada, it was the most common like place that weed came from, really kind of in Western Canada. The mayor of a small town near where I lived, her husband and children got busted for growing pot while I was working there. And the entire small town went so and reelected her.
So, yeah, that sounds about right.
So it's
at first I actually thought you said pop and not pot, and I was like, soda?
Oh yeah, the illegal Canadian soda mills. And also a lot of people on biodiesel buses.
A lot of people on biodiesel buses. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, so it's just like it's a small town that's just like it's got just like an insane amount of character and is in the middle of nowhere and is really just like very, very dedicated to making its own fun because of both of those facts. And I only worked there for 14 months because they were only paying me like $28,000 a year and my rent was taking up all of it.
Alrighty then.
See, journalism.
Yay.
But it's like lived rent free in my head ever since because it's just such a fascinating place.
Sounds like a good place to transform into like a urban fantasy center.
Right. I lived out of town, kind of on the other side of, there's a big lake that the town's built around, and I lived on the other side of that. And so I would just like leave my house and essentially pretty much be in the woods already anytime. And you could buy that, you know, like Bigfoot might be out here. There are like the 12 tribes have a farm. Why would werewolves not also have a farm?
Yeah, that seems fine. Yeah. So you've talked about before in an interview with HowlRound about how Me and AU was an experiment for you to learn how to juggle the different roles that solo podcasters have. And you kind of just like took on everything. And this is why no one in the show has footsteps, because fuck that. sound designing the first time is hard enough. I'm sure that everybody will be really curious about all the constraints that you were working with and what you discovered because of them.
One thing is that didn't turn out to be totally true. In the end, Aaron Bauman agreed to sound design the show and totally saved my bacon. So I only ended up sound designing the preview trailer. Yeah, which was awesome because it meant that it sounds better than it would have otherwise. but the show is written with the assumption that I was going to have to sound design it. So there are some specific constraints that I did build into the show. The main kind of construction thing for the show is that the show was kind of built to have modular soundscapes is how I always thought about it. So if you've listened to the show, you'll notice that like the internet has a very specific sound that we hear over and over again. Kate's like monologue space has a very specific sound that we hear over and over again. The coffee shop has a very specific sound that we hear over and over again. And the idea was that we were mostly just going to kind of return to these sound stages over. I should have called them sound stages in my head until now. That's a much better term.
Yeah, there you go. It's a very good term. Well done.
But yeah. So we returned to these like specific kind of soundscapes over and over again with the idea that I could theoretically kind of do them once and then not have to worry so much about like having to fully design these things if I ended up having to do all of the sound design myself. I'm really very grateful to Erin that I didn't, because what she did with like my idea of the internet should have sound that should be large, I think, is probably much better than I would have come up with.
Well, thank God for Erin.
Yeah, sound designers are great. But yeah, that was a lot of what it was. That's a lot of the reason the show is structured the way it is, why it has like kind of limited sets, fairly limited cast. Is also because I was, you know, writing, directing, producing, scheduling, and doing everything but the sound design myself. I kind of wanted to make it easy.
Parosion has a mentorship program called Rocket Booster, where you give feedback and consulting on a podcaster's first few episodes. I think it's really cool. I saw that you did it recently. What advice have you learned to give now based on your experience with me and AU?
I think, yeah, the advice that I have given the last couple of times we've done it and that I'd probably give going forward is just more around, don't feel like you have to make things that are complicated, and like do some things to help yourself out where you can, especially because, you know, a lot of my favorite shows are honestly not very complicated in terms of sort of the general setup. Like, I like a lot of single narrator shows that do most of their work just with one or two really good voices and ambient music. And I think you can. I know there's always discourse about, oh, that's so played out, but it's still a really powerful way to make a show.
Oh, of course. I think that a lot of people misunderstand the power of narrators. I mean, narrators are just a tool like any other thing that you use in creative writing to deliver an effect. They're a tool, and they can be used well, and they can be used poorly. Right. Just like everything else that you use in fiction writing.
Yeah, like you do not have to. Like, if you really want to write a genre show your first time out, that's fine. I also did that. There are ways to make that easier on yourself. Like, if Alex and I hadn't set our show in a closed environment where there were a limited number of characters and a limited number of soundscapes, and also you could do a lot by just having the engine always be going, we would have had a harder time.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah, so I think that's really wonderful advice. I think that this it ties back to some advice that we've heard before from Aaron Keon, who's one of the creators of Love and Luck from Australia, who talks about how when you're making, you know, your first podcast or even, you know, future podcasts, one of the things that can help you instead of hinder you are the constraints that you have just because of things like finances or how many people you have who will work with you or things like that. And working with those constraints and thinking about them and how to adapt your fiction to them can make for some really impressive, intimate, you know, if it's just your voice, like having just one person speaking to one person kind of intimacy sounds. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like,
fully agree.
You know, audio intimacy it's good. It's a big thing. I mean, I feel like if audio intimacy didn't exist, I don't think me and AU would work.
No, it wouldn't. I think you're right. Right. And I think also that, like, you know, people like to throw around, you know, the word intimacy, like, oh, audio is intimate. That's why it works, without really defining it. So much that at some point, depending on who's writing the article, it loses meaning. Yeah, it's intimate. Just kind of like, great. What do you mean? So Me and AU is a genuinely hopeful, cute, lighthearted romance. And Kate's narration is specifically addressed to Ella, which is almost like this whole show is a personal podfic for Ella about their relationship.
Oh, I really love that way of explaining it.
What made you decide to structure the story like this and to write the narrator portions like that?
I think I'm going to, this might be giving myself too much credit, but the thing that I think is true about me and AU is that I was trying to kind of like mirror the feeling of sort of building one of those relationships in fandom. And a lot of that is, in my experience, a thing that sort of happens in, to use Tumblr for an example, but this can happen over like any social media platform, is that a lot of that intimacy can kind of happen in your ask box or your DM space. That feeling of sort of like going from being a person that you casually send messages to the point where you are like telling this person your life story in, you know, however many characters you get in the ask box until you remember that email's a thing, is I think a really like kind of pivotal part of how these relationships actually work and what makes them work and makes them feel so important when you're having one. And that's really kind of what the narrator portion is in a lot of ways. Like, despite the fact that we also literally see them in each other's ask boxes, I think the narrator portion is the part where that gets really real. And kind of also to the point of the stuff that Kate can't actually type yet in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. So long distance romance and friendships that lead to these kinds of relationships is one of the cores of this story. And you've been in a lengthy long distance relationship. What do you think people misunderstand about long distance romantic relationships, especially, I might note, in the queer community?
Like my big number one is that people think trust is more of an issue than it is. I don't think, I mean, I'm sure people do, but my experience of queer long distance is like that has, I have never been concerned that like, oh, the person that I am with is like hanging up from their video chat with me and then like absolutely slipping into somebody else's DMs to be like, hey, you up, you live three blocks from me. Let's I can't bang.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yes, we witness here the suave DM DM knowledge that is definitely found in Kate.
Listen, I got my fiance to date me by writing her 2,000 words of smut. I don't know how to flirt with people normally.
You were not kidding when you said me and you was based on your personal experiences, huh?
Oh, yeah. Alana and I, Alana's my partner, are the boring version of Kate and Ella, where you know each other for 4 years first. You meet in person. You go, oh, shit. And then you spend 6 months going, yeah, I really like this girl. I'm going to proceed to do nothing about this for another day. Until you send her a mixtape of love songs just because you know she is interested in hearing what kind of love songs you like. And she goes, hey, why are we not dating?
Could you be any more queer if you tried?
Kate is smarter than me is the thing. I don't think people understand.
Disaster queer strike again.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
But yeah, other than trust, let's see, what else is there? I think just like, it's again kind of about like what can be an intimate partnered experience, which is a wild way to put watching the Great British Baking Show together. but you really, In some ways, it's like emotional U-hauling, but also you live in different countries.
Yeah, it probably doesn't help, huh? With the U-haul, I mean.
I had a really good thought for what's a thing people don't understand about long-distance relationships, and then I lost it again. Oh, here's actually one that's very podcast relevant. The thing that people do not understand about long-distance relationships probably is how weird it is when they stop being long-distance. The first time, even if you met somebody in person and then started dating them, which is my experience, when you have to meet each other again as, like, people who are now officially in a long-distance relationship, it is the weirdest thing, despite the fact that also you have, like, soul-bared to this person for however long.
Yeah, the physicality of it.
Yeah, it's no matter how, like, intimate you are with somebody in, like, a screen space, it is not the same as being in meet space with them, and suddenly their face moves a lot more.
I'm very curious as to if more people understand this now after the pandemic.
Probably, yeah. I suspect that a lot of people are going to really feel that during the next kind of however many months.
However long it takes. For people to, like, start being able to, like, see each other again. A couple of months ago, I saw, I was going past the park in a car, and I saw two teenagers run at each other from, like, opposite ends of a park. And one of them picked up the other one and, like, swung her around. And I was just like, ah, someone's been vaccinated. Like, there's just no way, right? So let's talk about fandom for a little bit here. Fun stuff. I have many, many varied questions about fandom because this is a very pertinent topic online right now. most recently, in the fiction podcast community, we had a 45-tweet long thread from Will Williams, the audio producer for this show, about parasocial relationships.
I saw that.
It's a very good thread. We've also had an article in Teen Vogue from media critic and analyst Stitch about celebrity parasocial relationships. It's very good. I recommend people read it. First, let's define this for our audience together. So I'm going to start. So parasocial relationships are completely normal. They happen to everybody. One-sided relationships that people develop with artists and creators and stars and other types of people that they might see or hear in the media that people consume. What else would you want to tell people about parasocial relationships who didn't know about them?
Ooh, yeah, good question. Nobody is immune, I feel like, is a big part.
Absolutely, yeah. This happens with everyone, right? And one of the things that was mentioned either in the thread or in the article, I've forgotten, or someone commented it, but that the relationship is like the relationship when it is neutral and you're deriving positive things from it is a lot more kind of like a mentorship, right? Even if it's one-sided, but it is related tangentially, right? To like mentor-mentee relationships in the way that they like develop and the things that they provide. What is it about parasocial relationships in fandom that has helped you? And in the case of me and AU, helps Kate?
It's an interesting question because it's kind of is and isn't the way I sometimes think about like fandom when it's about a fictional thing. But I think it does still apply here because I think it is like, I think anyone who's been in sort of... transformative works fandom, which is what people who write fan fiction call it because we want to sound cool, is the experience of like working out your shit with a character who in some way reminds you of yourself is a pretty common experience, I would say. And I think that sort of is in a way where you see like fascinating sort of quasi parasocial fictional stuff happen. And I think what we ultimately sort of see be healthy and helpful for Kate is like being able to kind of see this person who has similar worries and wildly different circumstances figure their stuff out and move forward in a healthy way and kind of just prove that that's possible to do, even though the circumstances don't align and the solutions are not relevant to her because she's not dealing with a monster that kills people, per se.
Per se, you know, just ish, you know.
Adulthood's a lot of things. Capitalism is a lot of things, but the monster's a lot less tangible. That makes the show sound smarter than it is. It's not.
Oh, no.
Selkirk, I mean. Selkirk's not that smart.
Oh, Selkirk. All right, that's fair.
And I think that's one way to kind of mm-hmm. to kind of come at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's generally true for me too. That I have definitely like worked out some shit on some characters via either fanfic or analysis over the years, for sure. Definitely also not in this podcast or anything.
Or and definitely not, no.
But also, like, I think there is definitely, like, I get parasocial with other podcasters all of the time. Mm-hmm. I have to. I've never met most of them. I only know them as people on Twitter or occasionally in mm-hmm. Patreon discords. And I think there is, like, the good version of that is, like, where you can kind of take inspiration from other people and see that other people are doing things that are cool or that you would like to do and kind of try to use that as inspiration and inspire mm-hmm. yourself. And then the bad parts version of that can go a lot of different ways, because I was going to say what mine is, but mine is probably mild because it doesn't involve death threats.
Yeah.
Sometimes the internet's a mistake.
Sometimes the internet is a terrible place. I think that everybody here agrees.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, like the mild bad version is just like you feel like you have ownership over this person's life, or you start to really, really care about what this person thinks of you, a person mm-hmm. that they maybe kind of know exists.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, some of these other like really positive things that occur from parasocial relationships are and their inherent nature in how they function in fandom is things like meeting other people, right? Like,
yeah.
Literally, the Me and AU is about having met, like, Kate meeting the love of her life, right? And that's something that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't gotten attached to these fictional characters from Selkirk and started talking about them online.
Yeah, and, like, the community aspect is yep. hugely, hugely important to the point where I'm kind of amused that I forgot about it for a second. because, like, yeah, that is the other good parts version of this, is that you find people who have this interest with you, but then also who have other commonalities with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the bad parts version of that is, again,
one of the things that I talk about whenever I get asked to talk about the differences between fiction podcasts and radio dramas is that I bring up intimacy in a different definition, right? Because radio dramas were a family event, right? It's the radio. There was a time and a place, and you had to all be around, sitting around the radio, listening to the next installment. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do it. Cinemas literally did not run movies during a certain time slot for one of these things, for one radio drama.
Wow.
Yeah, like it was literally a 15-minute radio drama, and they would not run movies through the slot because they wouldn't get anyone.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Alas, that radio drama is extremely racist. Don't listen to it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, sorry. but, you know, that's something that happens. And it means that when you listen to those radio dramas in a group, you are not really getting the opportunity to consume the media by yourself first. You are immediately in the process of doing it in a group.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like a community, even if it's a little one, it's like a family community, but still. But in podcasting and lots of other of our digital media, right, it has the single focus point first before entering these bigger communities and fandoms. And I think that that's really prevalent to, you know, one of the reasons why it gets so difficult in the bigger fandoms is because, you know, people spend a lot of time by themselves first in comparison.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then suddenly it is sometimes kind of impossible to be alone with your thoughts about a piece of media.
Totally true. Alas. One of the things that Kate comments on is the reason at the beginning here is that the reason that the Selkirk fandom is so small is because it's a Canadian show that hasn't started airing in the U.S. yet. Tell me a little more about your thoughts here on the Americanization of media and the internet.
I feel like I sure have them. I think what's just kind of interesting to me is, and one of the reasons that me and AU like is consciously Canadian in just like very, very casual ways, not to like say anything about Canadian culture so much as just to be in a Canadian setting, is that I have to make myself make things that are Canadian. And I don't think I am alone in that. It was like, so The Big Loop is a podcast that exists, is how we're going to start this.
I love The Big Loop.
And so the first, right around the time, I think I was actually kind of getting myself psyched up for the idea that I was going to write this podcast. I listened to one of the first episodes of The Big Loop that is set in, I want to say it's like Canmore, which is, I want to say in Alberta. Yes, Canmore's in Alberta, Cranbrook's in BC. I gotcha.
Geography, nailed it.
Yeah, gave myself a high five. but yeah, so it's set in Canmore, which is a town that I have been to in Alberta. And it's just kind of set there. Like it's not incidental to the story, really, I wouldn't say in any way that they are in Canada particularly. And it was just sort of like, Paul Bay can do that. Paul Bay, who is a successful podcaster who makes like a lot of stories that incidentally have Canadians in them. But just like, it was so weird to me that you would do that just because I think it's so easy to kind of Americanize, like, Alex and I, neither of us are American. She lives in Hong Kong. I live in Canada. But station to station is pretty American and British. Just because I don't even know what our thought process was anymore. She might still remember, but it just kind of, it's so easy to just tilt yourself towards the people you know are going to listen to the show and make it frictionless for them. And I think there are lots of artists in Canada who are not doing this, like in the literature scene, in TV. There are definitely like examples of really, really great stuff that is consciously really Canadian. Slings and Arrows is kind of like the obvious old favorite. Schitt's Creek is one of the reasons I think, and I hope this means Dan Levy has worked forever. I literally can't think of a third TV show, though, so that's not great. Letterkenny. Yeah, Letterkenny is another example of like a thing that Americans watch now that is really, really unapologetically Canadian. But it's like they're rare enough that I can like pull them out as like specific kind of little gems of this is a thing that like is Canadian, is like obviously Canadian and fundamentally culturally Canadian, and yet Americans still liked it. And we get kind of like weirdly excited about it when it happens. And yeah, it's just, and I think in podcasting in particular, like it's very easy if your story doesn't have to be Canadian not to make it Canadian. And I'm trying to push that back on that, at least for myself, because I don't know shit about America.
You're fine.
It's a different culture. Like my partner is Californian. I've spent a lot of time in California over the last 5 years. It is we are not culturally that similar, despite both being in Cascadia. It's fine. But like, there's no reason I can't just like write stuff where people hang out in Kamloops instead of hanging out in like Spokane.
Seems correct to me. No, I have a lot of these feelings as well, right? Because I'm from Puerto Rico, right? And I'm from a colonized place. Mm-hmm. And so the Americanization of everything always just kind of makes me go, absolutely not.
Yeah, and I mean, you come to it from, like, that's such a... The Canadian version of that is just, like, we have an inferiority complex while also being a white settler state. So I can't, like... Yeah. I can't claim quite that level of it, but...
Right. I think it might be, it's very salient in podcasting at this point, however, right? Because, I mean, there's so, people associate podcasts very heavily with the U.S.
Yeah.
Very heavily, right? And so, I mean, we even have the U.K. even has a problem, right, where the BBC is like, you know, this giant institutionalized entity for radio and podcasting and audio, and getting funding for podcasts in the UK is basically almost impossible unless you cozy up to the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's like this, and this happens elsewhere with institutionalized radio places, right? Institutionalized audio places. And it's just this, you know, because podcasts live on the internet, suffering from the Americanization, like as a side effect of also had what when it happens on the internet, which is always, it's just very frustrating for everybody involved.
Oh yeah, and I mean, like, that's also a fandom conversation too. The number of days I have gone without seeing a Tumblr post go by that's like, it's really would be cool if people on Tumblr could remember that people live in countries other than America is probably always a zero.
Yeah, that happens on Twitter a lot too.
Yeah,
I don't exist in any fandom spaces really. It's not really my thing, especially as a media critic. It just feels weird to me.
That's fair.
but you know, it still comes across my space because one of the things is like, you know, I do fandom analysis and I read people who do this stuff, right? And so it comes across my feed, and yeah, it's not. It's not never, you know?
No. Yeah, like I am not. I consume a lot of, like, fandom analysis stuff, partially because while I was writing Me and AU, I realized I kind of needed to, mm-hmm. because part of one of the things about being in small fandoms is you are checked out of a lot of that conversation, or you have the luxury of being checked out of that conversation is how I would actually put that. Mm-hmm. And, like, fascinating stuff that like the podcasts I listen to about fandom are discoursing on is like the habit of people like taking popular fandoms that are, you know, Chinese and Korean and then writing American teenager modern AUs about yeah. them is like kind of a primo example of that and also some other wild bullshit.
Oh yes, much of it. I would definitely recommend people follow Stitches Media Mix on Twitter if you want to learn more about fandom stuff.
Her Patreon also slaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I would love to talk here about headcanons. since, you know, it's AU, it's all literally about an alternate universe, writing this, you know, giant fan fiction of, like, the dude is a werewolf kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will absolutely be upfront about this, just to, you know, help you along. I do headcanon Kate as Low Vision. Because the computer voice that's used in the first episode is the same voice that my first screen reader used.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yes. and then the fact that the transcripts, you know, if anyone reads the transcripts, you know, you'll see that it says like podfic, right? And that's like the description of the soundscape that you're entering. And that really triggers this like, oh yeah, I do like listening to fan fiction. It's podfic when my eyes are tired and I don't want to look at anything anymore.
Cool. That's so rad. That's yeah. really cool.
In your experience, right, what is the value of headcanons in fandom?
I think, like, a couple of things. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes they're just, like, a fun way to play with a universe when you do not have the bandwidth to, like, write fic or create fan art. Mm-hmm. They're like a pretty low barrier to entry way to do like creative work. Because you can, like, some of the best conversations I've had, and some of the best friends I've met, I have met by saying like silly stuff. Like, I think Jack Holden is a ginger.
Extremely good.
Yeah. And just like the conversations that you can have off of that are fun because it's also a way that like multiple people can kind of contribute to building out an idea to an extent that fanfic very rarely is. Mm-hmm. You can have kind of that collaborative creative conversation in whatever kind of real time your social media platform operates in. And then the other, like, I think big obvious one is that it's kind of a fun way to take the things about yourself that you see in this character and then tangibly connect them up to stuff that you experience yourself that mm-hmm. the character does not canonically experience, which is like you talking about Kate being low vision or me talking about how every single character in every piece of media is bisexual.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, JPEG of Marge Simpson holding a potato, I just think they're bi.
Honestly, that's valid. One of the things that I watch a lot of is I watch a lot of older murder mysteries and stuff, right? Miss Marple and Poirot and all these things, right? And for the ones that is specifically for the ones for the shows that were made in like the 70s and the 80s and in that time period, I love it when they're very clearly signaling, because that's what the author intended, that these people are a gay couple. But nothing actually happens with that. But it's a very clear signal. And the author, depending on the author, right, they usually meant to signal that. And so I'm just sitting there like, they're gay. They live together. They knit together. They're very happy. Take that.
Yes. Yes, good.
And it's also just, it's really fun, right? I mean, headcanons, you know, have helped people do a lot of things. I mean, I've heard people who use headcanons in order to work out things about themselves. People
for
use
sure.
headcanons, right, to figure out that they're trans and things like this.
Yeah, and I think the only reason I, like, stuttered over how to say that is because I don't want to be, like, that somehow replaces the work of, like, actual media representation.
No.
But I think it's, like, a cool, kind of, like, powerful thing you can do for yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. Like, we shouldn't be relying on headcanons to be the way that we get this kind of work, right? That's not... It doesn't really do anything for the wider communities and societies at large, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very personal thing, and, you know, you can take it to your therapist, and maybe you find out that, you know, you're trans. It's great. this is not based on personal experience.
No,
or
I didn't think so.
And I've met people who figured out they were autistic because of this. Okay, last question that I have right
All
now.
Right.
In that interview with HowlRound in 2019... You teased a mystery show called Deadbeat, set in a farmer's market, coming 2022. It's 2021. Is this real?
Yes and no. So the outline for Deadbeat exists in my notebook.
Okay, excellent.
It is planned. The problem is that I started writing Selkirk for real.
Oh my god. Are we going to get Selkirk the podcast?
Yeah, probably.
Oh my god, that's amazing!
One of my Patreon goals was that I would make the pilot for Selkirk if we reached a certain threshold that I didn't think we were going to reach, and then we reached it really fast.
Oh no.
Because self-confidence is a thing. And so then I made it. I wrote the script and I sent the script to everybody, and my cast has been bullying me about making this show basically the entire time we were making the NAU. and it turns out it's really fun to write, because it's fun to write a thing that you've already told yourself is bad.
Yeah, that's fair.
It really takes the pressure off in a fascinating way. Like, I'm sitting there writing, I was writing episode 3 a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, none of this makes any sense. So I think I'm hitting the brief.
Yeah, no, yeah, I nailed it.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Oh my god, that's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, it only took like 11 years for this to become a real project of its own.
I'm sorry, 11 years?
Oh yeah, so Selkirk is inspired by Nelson, but I also tried to write it a couple times as a novel while I was still living there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you can't write a novel while you're working a 70-hour week for 28K.
No.
It turns out.
No, you can't. Turns out.
Yeah. I also just wasn't... I wasn't ready to write it. Original Selkirk's pretty mean.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah, I am... I needed, like, another decade to be more interested in things that are kind.
Yeah. We all have those moments.
Yeah.
I think leaning into compassion for those kinds of things is always very important.
And also to just chill out a little bit, given that, like, the big thematic thing of both of these is stop worrying about decisions you haven't made.
Wait. Stop? My anxiety says go, though.
Well, stop worrying about the decisions and make decisions and then worry. is my inspiring message to people.
I mean, we do like to make decisions.
Just gotta do stuff.
I actually missed one question that I'm going to ask you. So one of the things that's very clear in me and AU is that you have absolutely nailed the Tumblr vibes. from things like, since exactly one person asked for it, here's this essay, to like quirky, lengthy, one-time tags. What do these various specific turns of phrase trigger for you in creating atmosphere and tone?
So when I was trying to set myself up to write the show, and the reason I keep saying it that way is because I have like horrible writer's anxiety.
You're valid. Same.
Yeah. Lol.
I have 7 articles that I need to write. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
I decided that the way that it was going to be really, really easy for me to get through a first draft, if I was just like, I'm going to write this the way I would write an actual Tumblr post. And then I realized that is actually like a pretty distinctive character voice.
Yes.
But yeah, I wanted... I go back and forth, like, literally every time I think about it, about, like, where on the spectrum I fall of, like, a deep, sincere, genuine, no-frills affection for, like, Tumblr fandom and, like, gentle mockery of Tumblr fandom. And it's all somewhere in there all of the time.
Yeah, it's all there.
Because it's an absurd space, and I love it. And it's silly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that it did for me, like hearing these turns of phrase, is just reminding me that when I started out in Tumblr, for like the majority of time that I was on Tumblr, I was not in fandom spaces. Mm-hmm. I was in a completely different part of Tumblr. But I would still occasionally see these things come across my dashboard, right? And every time I would see one of these turns of phrase for the first time, I'd just be like, what? What does this mean? Luckily, I'm a linguist.
That does help.
Helps. Tumblr's a weird place, and then Yahoo bought it.
Yeah, there's a reason the show is secretly a period piece.
The show is secretly a period piece, yes. There is just no way that it's not, especially with that the tag that she mentions in the second episode.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the calendar that the show is based on is set in 2015.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Very specific year.
It's the year It's the year I met my partner. It's the year I met my partner.
Aw. That's so cute.
I will secretly encode my sappiness into my audio drama.
Absolutely good. This explains why me and AU just feel so, it just feels so real. I think that's one of the things that I was talking about with people when it was coming out, is that it feels very much like a online relationship, right? And so, you know, all the best stories have grains of truth in them.
Yeah.
Varying sizes of grains.
I don't think I could write some... It's hilarious that my close to the bone story is that, but...
If you liked what you heard, you can support me and AU's future work at patreon.com/meandau. You can find more ways to support other works by the Procyon Podcast Network at procyonpodcastnetwork.com. Radio Drama Revival runs on adrenaline shots to the heart and delivery french fries. If you'd like to help keep us afloat in featuring new, diverse, unique fiction podcasts and their creators, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/radiodramarevival. And now we bring you our moment of Anne.
The month of June is upon us, my friends. And that means it's time to be unapologetically gay. Unless you're always shouting about being queer like most of our team is. In which case, keep it up.
That means it's time for the credits. This episode was recorded in the unceded territory of the Kalapuya people, the Klitskani Indian tribe, the Cowlitz Indian tribe, and the Otfalati tribe. Colonizers named this place Beaverton, Oregon. If you are looking for ways to support or donate to Native communities, the Kamloops Aboriginal Friendship Society is seeking donations to build a new center. KAFS offers many services and programs for urban-located Indigenous people, such as healthcare initiatives, outreach programs for children and youth, childcare, and food hamper and nutrition programs. You can support them at charity.gofundme.com/o/en/campaign/new-friendship-center, which is linked in the episode description. Our theme music is Reunion of the Space Ducks by the band Kylo Kaz. You can find their music on Free Music Archive. Our audio producer is Will Williams. Our marketing manager and line producer is Ann Baird. Our researcher is Heather Cohen. Our submissions editor is Rashika Rao. Our associate marketing manager is Jillian Schrager. Our transcriptionist is Katie Yeomans. Our audio consultant is Eli Hamada McElveen. Our associate producer is Sean Howard. Our executive producers are Fred Greenhalgh and David Reinstrom. Our mascot is Ticker Tape, the goat. I'm your host, Elena Fernandez Collins. This has been Radio Drama Revival. All storytellers welcome.